Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, March 10th, 2007. I'm Harley Schlanger and I'll be your host today. On Wednesday of this past week, Lyndon LaRouche threw down a serious challenge to the American people. He said, either act now to defeat the dangerously genocidal policies being pushed by the Malthusian agent of the British, Al Gore, or the United States and the world will disintegrate into a global dark age. In his webcast, which is archived on the website LaRouchePact.com, so you can listen to it in full, LaRouche demolished the fraud that's in the anti-scientific method of Gore and his allies. The only question that remains after listening to LaRouche and looking through what we've been publishing in the EIR and elsewhere, the only question that remains on the table is, do you, the listeners, have the guts to stand for the truth and base our nation's economic and energy policy on real science? Or will you allow the tricks of these sophists to take our nation and your future into hell? Joining us today on the LaRouche Show will be Larry Hecht. Larry is the editor-in-chief of 21st Century Science and Technology magazine, and he's a leading debunker of scientific fraud, as well as a scientist in his own right. Larry, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
I think some of you may have heard a little bit of what Larry had to say 2-3 weeks ago, but we wanted to give him the full hour today to develop these questions, because this really is a moment of existential crisis for our nation. And making the right decision on this Gore global warming fraud really will determine the direction of the country for the next 2-3 generations. Joining us as our LaRouche Youth Movement panel today, we'll have Wesley Irwin, who's in Washington, D.C. Hello, Wes.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, and we'll also have Natalie Lovegren, who's here in our studio in Houston, Texas. Hi, Natalie.
Hello.
So, Larry, let's get right down to it. What's wrong with the allegation that's at the heart of Gore's agenda, that human activity is the cause of global warming?
Okay, well, just under 3 weeks ago, a leaflet hit the streets, authored by me, called The Fraud of Global Warming, True CO2 Record Buried Under Gore. And what we took up in that leaflet was the point that most clearly exposes the fraud of which is a giant fraud, that of global warming, which is the claim that that human produced CO2 from burning of fossil fuels and so forth is affecting the climate, and in fact affecting it so severely that within years we're going to see the polar ice caps are going to melt and we're going to be flooded in water and basically drowning in our own gore. That turns out to be a complete and total fraud. And what exposes it more clearly than anything else is some recent evidence that was turned up by a professor in Freiburg, Germany, who's been working on this for quite a number of years, Ernst Georg Beck. Dr. Beck is a collaborator of Dr. Jarowski from the Polish Radiation Monitoring Service and a veteran of 17 expeditions to glaciers on 6 continents. He's one of the people, a leading debunker of the global warming fraud. In fact, he appeared on this recent British television show last Thursday. From what I've heard of reports, it was a nice debunking. But what Dr. Beck uncovered was that in the going all the way back to the 19th century, going all the way back practically to the beginning of modern chemistry, which dates from the work of the 1780s and 90s of Antoine Lavoisier, there have been measurements, direct chemical measurements, and very accurate ones, of the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. And the vast majority of these measurements were ignored by the proponents of the global warming theory. They simply falsified the data and read these readings out of existence.
All right, Larry, let's just explore this for a minute. You're saying that there were accurate readings that were recorded of the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere going back to the beginning of the 1800s?
Exactly right. And these were read out of existence by the global warming proponents.
Now, why would they do that?
For the reason, that's what I was just about to say. For the simple reason that they want to show that there's been a steady increase in the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere due to human industrial activity. Now, of course, that's, you know, that's a hypothesis one could entertain. After all, we know from the great biogeochemist Vernadsky has pointed out that human activity is becoming biological activity affects the Earth. He once said that human beings have a geological effect on the biosphere. So it certainly is an entertainable hypothesis that human industrial activity might have such an effect. However, this has been researched for a long period of time, and the truth is that carbon dioxide is, well, let's get to the basic facts. The truth is that there is an effect called the greenhouse effect, that is the warming of the atmosphere by incoming solar radiation not reflecting back out because of the gases in the atmosphere. We need that.
So that, you're not saying there's no such thing as a greenhouse
effect? Oh, no, the greenhouse effect exists. And this has been known since the early 19th century as well, and it's a very important effect because without it we would be freezing to death. The Earth would simply reflect off the radiation and we would have absolute zero temperatures here. So that wouldn't be very nice. It's important to have an atmosphere. It's also important to be able to breathe it. So and it's important for plants, to have carbon dioxide. When the effect of carbon dioxide on plant life was first discovered, you know, it got the name the gas of life. Because no plants can't grow without CO2. So, but what shows that this is a fraud more clearly than anything else is that in order to get this fake curve, it's called the Keeling curve after Charles Keeling, who's the author of this, one of the authors of this fraud, perhaps not the worst of them, but one of them. I think Al Gore's the worst, though he didn't invent any of it. They want to show a curve that simply goes along flat all the way back in the 1800s, back in the 1700s, back in the BC time, back 100,000 years ago, pretty much flat at about the level of 250 parts per million of CO2. And then suddenly, recently, it starts to rise and then goes up exponentially, up to levels of, they claim, around now 380, even 383 parts per million. And all of that is due to the carbon dioxide that comes from fossil fuel burning. Well, the problem is that it's not true. The problem is that curve never existed. The problem is that 90,000 direct measurements out of hundreds of thousands, 90,000 were selected by Professor Beck, some of them going back to the 1800s, showing that there were periods in history in the past when readings of CO2 went as high as 470 parts per million, so much higher than anything that we have now. One of the recent periods was from about 1935 to 1942. So when measurements in Germany and Austria and other places showed these levels of CO2. The fact is, there is no such thing as a pure CO2 reading. We measure CO2 now. The official reading station is in Mauna Loa on top of Hawaii. Now, the Mauna Loa station, which is an old World War II meteorological station, happens to sit on top of an active volcano. So tell me if you think an active volcano, which is continuously outgassing, is going to give you a pure reading of the atmospheric content of any gas.
Well, Larry, what Gore cites are readings in the ice, and they're saying that that's how they can determine this flat curve up until the recent period.
Right, exactly. What they've done is they've thrown out all of the real measurements that were taken, actual, you know, weather station chemical measurements, and they've replaced it with a proxy record. And the proxy record is the ice cores. And the idea is that gas bubbles called gaseous inclusions are incorporated into the ice as the ice freezes. And as the ice gets packed down, let's say you take an Antarctic ice core, which might go down 1 to 2 miles deep, you will find in that, as you drill up those ice cores, you will find in the lower parts of the ice core a preserved sample of what the atmospheric air was 5,000, 10,000, even 100,000 or 160,000 years ago. Unfortunately, It would be nice if you could do that. Unfortunately, it doesn't work. Unfortunately, the world's leading, Dr. Jaworski, I mentioned earlier, is the world's leading expert on this aspect of glaciology, has been studying this thing for the past 25 years, even longer, has shown that when ice freezes, there are 20 different chemical and mechanical and physical processes that take place. I mean, just think about it. You get a gas bubble included into the ice, then the ice melts. Then there's water around again. Well, carbon dioxide, of all the atmospheric gases, happens to be the most soluble in water, especially likes to go into cold water.
So it doesn't exactly lend itself to layers that can be easily measured as year by year.
It doesn't just not lend it to itself to that. It gives a completely false reading of that. And in fact, what the ice record shows, when you do it that way, is you just see an absolutely steady reading over hundreds of thousands of years. Even though we know from vast numbers of other evidence, and no one disputes this within climatology, that the temperature has varied as much, the average global temperature has varied as much as 6 degrees centigrade, over 10 degrees Fahrenheit variation in the global temperature. I mean, we've gone through severe ice ages with the ice pouring down on over Canada into down to the level of New York City and Chicago, covered in a mile deep layer of ice. That's called, you know, that's a glaciation. And these have occurred in 100,000 year cycles for the past at least 1 to 2 million years. So we know that climate has vastly changed. Yet, if climate were driven by CO2, then surely we should see such a record of change in CO2 in the ice.
Well, Larry,
let me
just ask you then. Beck's study presumably is known by people who participated in the IPCC conference recently, which gave credibility to this argument of the CO2 changes in the ice. Don't they know about Beck's record? And if so, how can they just write it off?
The whole thing is a hoax, Harley, and it's been this CO2 business has been – people have tried to kick this up since – there was a famous paper in 1938 by a man named Guy Stewart Callender, who proposed this CO2 hypothesis then. In order to justify it, he cherry-picked the data. Later studies, there was a famous study in 1953 by the National Weather Service, Giles Slocum, who showed that he had simply cherry-picked the data, and his figures showing, you know, which cohere with what Gore's fraud shows now, around in the 260s and 280s parts per million of CO2, were just wrong. Just look at the data, and you found that the average was 335. And that it hadn't, back in the 19th century, and that it hadn't changed. So even based on the data they were choosing, they didn't have the ice cores then. It was wrong. It was fake. And these people seem to have an unlimited capability to take the data that they want, to massage it and manipulate it, and to come up with that they have an agenda.
It sounds like Cheney's Defense Department.
Doesn't it?
And you're listening to Larry Hecht on the LaRouche Show. It's March 10th, 2007. And we're looking at this question of the fraud of big fat Al Gore. Now, Larry, let's take up this question then. You have the argument that we hear all the time from people in the street and on campuses. They say, well, it's now a proven fact that all scientists agree. There's a scientific consensus. If, in fact, that's not true, how do they get away with that? What are they doing to – are they silencing some of these people who are contrarians?
Yeah, well, you know, when LaRouche was asked a similar question at the webcast, you may recall, he pointed to Lynn Cheney's operation on the campuses, this ACTA grouping, which is a new McCarthyite grouping that does silence people. We pointed out the silencing of people who are objecting to the neocon war policy. So, of course, there's the idea that academia is somehow this value-free, just, you know, seeking after the truth and so forth. That's what it should be. But, you know, as we've discovered, as members of the LaRouche Youth Movement have discovered, if you want to get to truth, you have to step outside the universities. You have to really fight for it. So, of course, it isn't. And, of course, careers are made and broken on the basis of where you stand on this. There's, you know, we just recently identified in our briefing four different cases from many, many more of people. I'll give you one, an expert on malaria from the Pasteur Institute. His name is Paul Ryder, and actually he's wrote an article in 21st Century Science some years ago on the malaria question. They had him as a French representative to the IPCC because, remember, they go broad on this, and one of the claims they wanted to make is that, you know, everything bad is going to happen if global warming happens, and so malaria is going to increase, according to them. Well, Ryder showed that that was nonsense, that the malarial mosquitoes can exist at a warmer and colder temperatures, even if there were global warming, and what's causing malaria increases is lack of public health, lack of pesticide use, lack of spraying with DDT and other effective pesticides. So that was just nonsense. He never agreed with it. The IPCC report was preliminary report was just issued with his name on it, and what happened was he was in the news just recently for saying that this is a sham, this idea that this is a unanimity of scientific opinion. He said, in order to get my name off of that, because I didn't agree with it, I had to threaten a lawsuit.
Now, so basically you do have ongoing debates in the scientific community then, and from what we've reported recently, there's some very interesting hypotheses that go outside of the realm of human activity with this Danish study, the observations from Russia. Why don't you just give us a little bit of a background on some of what are the other kinds of discussions that we're just not hearing in the media?
Yeah, well, that gets really interesting because back in the early or beginning of this century, there was some work that really goes all the way back to the work of Kepler on the elliptical orbits that showed that there would be that because of the changes in the Earth's relationship to the Sun, the inclination of the Earth's axis changes over a cycle of about 40,000 years, the something called the precession of the equinox, which determines whether summer and winter are occurring when the Earth is nearest to the Sun or furthest away, and another cycle which actually changes the major axis of the ellipse of the elliptical orbit itself of the Earth and the other planets, and that's almost a 100,000-year cycle, that these cycles can change the amount of solar radiation reaching the Earth. And, of course, it's solar radiation. If you want to know what is causing climate, it's changes in solar radiation, of which there are many, many causes. These studies got put together. It became known as the Milankovitch cycle theory of climate. These studies indicated remember, people were very interested then in the advance and retreat of glaciers, and there was beginning to come up geological evidence that there had been periods of history where the northern hemisphere had been covered with ice all the way down to Chicago and New York, and in Europe all the way down to northern France and so forth. There was great evidence for this, and that the glaciers had advanced and retreated. So they, by putting together this astronomical data and making calculations of what would be the changes in solar radiation reaching the Earth, were able to show that there would be a cyclical change, and they predicted how it would change. And over the years, over the next 40, 50 years, it was a beautiful work within many, many fields of geology and involving isotope records. And climatology is a wonderful multidisciplinary science. It's a shame that it's been turned into this hoax-generating instrument.
Because now, Larry, no one argues that human activity ended the Ice Age, right?
Yeah, good point. We were not producing enough carbon dioxide to end the Ice Age, and the Ice Age ended, and a huge ice sheet went back. Very good point.
But the reason I raise that is that it's clear when you look at what you presented in that leaflet, which has been mass distributed, and we'll hear very shortly from members of the LaRouche Youth Movement who have been taking this fight into the Congress and into the population. But it's clear from that, what you reported in the leaflet and what we've been reporting consistently in the EIR, that this is a fraud and that there are much better explanations, that including some of these more recent ones that we'll get to. So the next obvious question is Al Gore and the people who are pushing this must have some other agenda. And I'd like to just introduce that into the discussion now. What is behind this?
Yeah, don't they, though? We're dealing here with fascism. We're dealing here with something that was once called eugenics. Now, we're dealing with the same policy that was behind Hitler and that was behind the British promotion of Hitler, the promotion of Hitler by people including George Bush's family, whose grandfather put the money in to get the Nazi party into power. So what it's all about is very simple. They want to stop scientific and industrial progress. And obviously, if you say that the generation of energy and the operation of industry is warming up the Earth and destroying the Earth's climate for everybody else, then what you're saying is that we can't have industrial progress. You're saying to a country in Africa, you can't have a steel mill. Go try and run your steel mill on solar panels if you want to have a steel mill. You can't have power plants, all right? And that's what it's all about. That's what it's about from the beginning. The whole environmental movement that was introduced with, in the modern era with Prince Philip and Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. You know,
so this was a deliberate attack on the scientific method, which actually allowed for the increase in population.
They decided they could shut down science when Bertrand Russell engineered the Pugwash conferences and got the agreements with the Soviet Union that they would control the development of nuclear weapons. Then they decided they could put the clamp on. Before that, they figured, well, in order to control Eurasia and control the Soviets, which is what their geopolitics has been all about, they needed the rapid scientific advance. That was turned around, beginning in the 50s and strongly in the 60s. And there was a turning point, perhaps 63 to 68. And so science was closed down. The global warming, until then, ironically, in terms of climate science, because that's only a piece of it, of course, in terms of climate science, it was just at that time that the Milankovitch theory of climate cycles, of astronomical determination, was being verified. But there was a famous conference in 1976 in Washington, in the Washington area. Margaret Mead was one of the leading attendees, and Steve Schneider, the climate scientist who made the famous statement that we need to lie, that we have to simplify and twist the truth in order to ease it. Scientists have to learn how to not be so scientific about it, but simply make simple statements that the public can understand and don't worry about that. He literally said they don't have to be true. So at that conference, they introduced the global warming as the scare. Until that time, most of the popular press was talking about an ice age coming. But suddenly it's global warming and it's human industrial activity. So that's what it is. It's very simple aim. They want to stop industry and they want to stop the development of the developing world, and they want to stop progress in the advanced sector so human progress can't occur. That's what their damn scam is all about.
Well, let me
that's
give
what
a
Gore's about. It's evil.
Let me give a phone number for people to call in who want to get copies of the latest coverage of this in the EIR magazine, which we have devoted a number, about four or five of the last issues, including two lengthy scientific articles by Lyndon LaRouche on the biofuels and the most recent one on the fraud of Gore. You can get it by calling us at 800-278-3135. That's 800-278-3135. And tell them you heard it on the LaRouche Show, and we'll send you a copy of the most recent Executive Intelligence Review and its coverage of this fraud. Now, we are open for taking some emails. If you want to email a question to Larry or to our youth panel, you can do so by sending it to radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub.com. And I would encourage people, if you're sitting there scratching your head saying, you mean the Academy Award validated a fraud? If you think something like that, if you think that you don't agree with us, send us a message. Let's get into a discussion on this. Now, I'd like to bring in one of our LIM panelists, Wes Irwin, who's been in Washington, D.C. Wes, do people in the Congress understand that this is a fraud?
Well, it's a funny situation because a lot of the Democrats, of course, are already being pushed into this idea of reelection mode and the fundraising and all the things going on because of what the Senate candidates are doing. And so many of them would like to take advantage of the hoax by having Al Gore come and fundraise at one of their town meetings. But then on the other side, you've got the Republicans who despise Al Gore for other reasons, namely because he's perceived as being a liberal greenie, which is, you know, sort of a half-truth because he's a neocon, which a lot of people don't realize also. But I don't think that the people who are opposed to Gore namely in the Republican Party, even the Democrats, for the most part, are going after this hoax and after Gore for the right sort of reasons. And so I don't think that there is this sort of the awareness that has to be there, which is coming from the sort of perspective that LaRouche is coming from, which is the idea that we actually live in a dynamic universe of an interaction of principles, and that the only way that you can really understand what is occurring with geothermal changes of the sort we're talking about is from the standpoint of actually looking at the whole universe. Right? And then that brings in, you know, this issue of why LaRouche is having the D.C. local here that's working with the Congress directly, and then all the other locals that we have in the nation and around the world working on this Kepler material.
Well, Wes, this means you're actually going in now and talking to these congressmen and congressional aides about, I think, to paraphrase one of our signs, that Kepler repudiated global warming 400 years ago. We're actually discussing that now with congressmen and congressional aides, are we not?
Yeah, it's wonderful. I mean, it's absolutely true, and it's wonderful, and it's a lot of fun because it completely throws these guys for a loop. Why is it that, you know, you have youth going into the Congress and walking into an office and, you know, and then dropping off geometric solids like the icosahedron and the dodecahedron, you know, at the front desk for the aides to play with, you know? They've never seen anything like it. But it gets at this question of how you actually know truth, which is something that both the Republicans and the Democrats have a lot of work to do on. And as Lynn says, it goes back to the question of Egyptian spherics, where instead of approaching the universe from some sort of arbitrary definitions and axioms about the way the universe works, the way, you know, Gore does with this global warming hoax, what you would want to do is start from the standpoint of looking at the universe in terms of spherical geometry and the study of the heavenly bodies moving across the celestial sphere, right, as you look up in the nighttime sky. And then from that standpoint, how do you actually continue that method of discovery that the ancients, like Kepler and Kuza, were involved with into the current discussion today? How has that method evolved over time through the discoveries of guys like Kuza and Leibniz and Gauss and Riemann, and then applied in what some of the things that Vernadsky was looking at concerning the biosphere, and then Lynn's own discoveries on physical economics? So we're coming at the Congress from that standpoint, and it's just blowing these guys off their feet. I mean, they really don't see it coming, because even if they agreed with us on the single issue of this thing being a fraud, they still wouldn't be looking at it from the sort of truthful perspective of knowing real science Lyndon LaRouche does. So,
isn't that the same problem you have with economic policy and with dealing with strategic policy, that people go with the consensus, look for consensus?
Yeah, it's the same thing as with the peer review. But I mean, one thing that's absolutely apparent for the people who've actually seen the Inconvenient Truth movie, which will put you to sleep with Al Gore's monotone voice if you're not careful. But if you actually watch that movie, what you'll see is that Al Gore drafts this statistical linear correlation between the increase in carbon dioxide and the increase in temperature, as if temperature and carbon dioxide were the only two things that existed in the universe.
Wes, we're going to have to just go to break. We'll come back after the break and pick that up. You're listening to The LaRouche Show. We're live every Saturday on the web from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. And The LaRouche Show is archived on the LaRouchePub.com website so that you can go back and replay this show or any of our previous shows. Get your friends listening. Why don't you create a renaissance in your neighborhood by getting people to listen to the show, then get them the EIR, get them online with LaRouche publications, and let's turn this population into a thinking population rather than a bunch of people huddling like penguins in the South Pole looking for warmth. We got to create a bold population. So by doing that, by going online, listening to the LaRouche Show, and also you can call in to order copies of the material we're discussing today. That toll-free number is 800-278-3135, and we'll send you copies of the EIR. So you can go to LaRouchePub.com or call 800-278-3135. And while you're doing it, call in and make a contribution, because we need to print more of these, more of the written literature, and we also need to produce the DVD of the webcast just done by Lyndon LaRouche on the fraud of Al Gore. So do that today. Now, we're coming back on with Wes Irwin. Wes, you were just making the point that we're not simply dealing with mechanical statistical correlations. Why don't you finish your point?
Oh, well, because you'd asked about this question of economics, I mean, it's very interesting to look at how, you know, Al Gore uses this linear projection 50 years into the future between these two variables that seemingly, according to his analysis, exist in the universe, in some sort of like box universe, in which these are the only two things in existence. And if you look at economic policy, if you sit in on any of these undergrad economic classes, as many of us in the LaRouche Youth Movement do, when we want to, you know, maybe ruffle the feathers of a professor and have a good time, what you'll find is that these professors do the same sort of thing with the supply-demand curve, as if the only thing in the universe that exists is your emotional state that drives you at any given moment to pursue some sort of physical material object, and then the availability of that object is what determines the price of the object. And of course, in the sense of economics, it completely disregards the whole idea of how wealth is produced, what the value of something really is in terms of its value in relation to society as a whole, and all sorts of other factors, just as in the case of what they're trying to do in looking at climate change, disregards to a great extent the changes in solar radiation. What LaRouche has pointed out is changes in the heat directly coming from the sun, solar flares and so forth, and what doesn't even begin to consider things like the Crab Nebula, things outside of our solar system and even outside our galaxy that are emitting all sorts of cosmic rays that could be changing the climate on the planet. So.
And Larry, there was an irony, and I believe it was a report from the St. Petersburg Observatory, where they pointed out that there's a change in the temperature on Mars with the polar ice caps there, and that how could you argue that human activity is responsible for that?
Right. That's frozen CO2 on the Mars pole, and it was melting at the same time that we had a slight warming in the Earth's climate. And we're headed into a turn. What that same observatory, Polkovo in St. Petersburg, is saying is that looking simply at the curve of the radiance, of the intensity of solar irradiance, that we're about to go now into another cooling. There are short-term cycles in this, which is all that we've experienced recently.
Well, maybe George Bush and Cheney can cook up an attack on the sun.
Yeah, right.
Of course, Bush would say to avoid the heat, we have to go at night. Well, let's bring in Natalie Lovgren from Houston. Natalie, you just did a class the other day at the University of Houston where you were bringing up these questions of these longer-term cycles, the precession of the equinox, the wobble in the Earth's orbit. What kind of response were you getting from students?
Well, it generated quite a good bit of discussion. In the campus organizing generally, we've just had a lot of questions. First of all, people being struck with the paradox of, oh, hey, you guys are the people that are against Cheney and want to impeach Bush and Cheney, and that's great. Oh, wait a second. What are you saying about Gore? What's wrong with Gore? I mean, isn't global warming bad? Don't we have to stop the planet from overheating? But what we've found is this is a very superficial understanding, and it's just a lot of what people have seen on the media. And in the discussions, they'll throw out things like, well, I heard that all of the scientists agree with this conclusion, and so we just have to do something about it. And as soon as you start a discussion and say, well, first of all, look at the culture that you're dealing with and look at the type of selling out that you get in politics and even among your professors, where there's this type of climate of dishonesty in academia as well. Then it starts to get people to think. And then going into some of the scientific questions, they realize, oh, well, I haven't even thought about this. Of course, maybe the sun has something to do with global warming. So it's been a lot of fun. We've had some interesting reactions from people, but usually I've noticed it's more of the older generation. Once you get past your 30s and 40s, there's more of a, seems like an emotional connection to this environmentalism. Where
you mean the baby boomers?
Well,
you mean the baby boomers are sophists?
Yeah, it just seems generally I've noticed that the student population has been more willing to discuss the science of the matter. And
so, Natalie, then you're able to actually get people on the campuses to start taking up this question, or at least looking at why Lynn is insisting that we do the work on Kepler.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So all those years of brainwashing and thinking they had this generation in their back pocket didn't take. Nice to hear.
Well, Larry, let me get back to you, and we do have one question on the email that I'll take up in a few minutes. You're welcome to send in more questions. If we don't get to your questions on the air today, I will guarantee that Larry will answer them. So send them to us at radio@larouchepub.com, and we'll take them up. But, Larry, you're talking about the Gore hoax and this fraud. There's a long history of these kind of scientific hoaxes and fraud, all the way back to Aristotle, Galileo, and Newton.
Yeah.
Why? Why is there this desire to destroy the honest investigation in the physical universe?
I think it's the same reason as now. I think it's the same question of now. It's the question of stopping nuclear power and scientific progress, but it's always been that question. It goes back to Prometheus. You bring man fire, and you're disturbing the set order of the oligarchy. It's a question of your conception of man. If it's an oligarchical conception, if it's the conception that man is not made in the image of God, but as a beast, or most of us are beasts, and there's a few people who are elected to rule.
Super beasts.
Yeah, they're the super beasts, right. And so that's what we're dealing with here, very simply. And it's letting the genie of science out of the bottle is seen by these people as something dangerous. Most of us regard it as something wonderful. You know, I wanted to talk a little about that what Wes just mentioned, this discovery in Copenhagen, which came at a convenient time, or just as we were exposing this Gore's CO2 record buried in Gore. A couple of scientists at the Danish Space Agency had just completed an experiment, or just completed writing up the results of an experiment they had done over several years, which showed that the formation of clouds, especially of low-level clouds, which have the largest influence on climate, that is, everyone knows it's cooler on a cloudy day, and you can have vast differences in cloud formation in the Earth's atmosphere. But the formation of clouds, which would cool the Earth, correlates with the output of the amount of incoming cosmic radiation. They did an experiment that showed that these incoming particles, they're mostly protons of various different elements, coming from far distant space, from most of them within our galaxy. They're thought to come from locations like the Crab Nebula, which were exploded supernova. That are throwing off these huge numbers of elements. These things are always constantly bombarding the Earth, and they are actually forming our atmosphere. They form the ozone layer, and they're important in every way for life. But they vary. They vary in part because the magnetic field around the Earth varies. If you put a friend of mine does a nice experiment, puts a magnet on a TV screen, And by moving it around, you can get the figure to stretch, and you can put it on Al Gore's face and make him even uglier than he is by moving that magnet around, because the TV screen is made up of electrons being bombarding the screen, at least the old type. The flat screens are a little different. So if the magnetic field intensity changes, if it increases, it will deflect those incoming particles. If it decreases, more of them will come in. If more of them come in, more clouds are formed. If more clouds are formed, then the Earth gets cooler. And scientists had noticed a regular cycle that correlated with the sun's output. They didn't know in the cosmic radiation, but they didn't know the reason. This experiment shows a very direct link to the amount of incoming cosmic radiation and the formation of cloud nucleation particles. So this begins to get into the wonderful thing that Kepler was already thinking about way back 400 years ago, but you know, before we had the capability to get out that far in terms of our equipment, instrumentation. But now this opens the possibility of determination of events on Earth by things going on way out in the galaxy. And one of the most fascinating pieces of work related to this now we're getting outside of Denmark, but to a researcher in Israel, Nir Shaviv, who's an astrophysicist who collaborates with a Czech by the name of Jan Weitzer, who works in Ottawa, Canada. And they've put together, they've looked at the much longer-term cycles than we were talking about earlier, these recent 100,000-year variations in the ice ages. They're looking at 100-million-year cycles. It turns out, according to their work, that the Earth moves, the whole solar system has a motion with respect to the galaxy. The galaxy has four spiral arms. People have probably seen pictures of things like that. We're in a galaxy which we call the Milky Way Galaxy. There's about 143 million year period of that motion to move from one from the densest part of one spiral arm through relatively less filled parts of the galaxy into the next dense part of the spiral arm. So their idea is that within those spiral arms, there's a much denser accumulation of stars and star formation, and there are more of these cosmic ray emitting supernovae. So their idea is that what they've shown then is that on a 143 million year cycle, which you can gather out of the geological record, you get periods of very cold climate on Earth, sometimes called ice house Earth, and they show a correlation of that to the motion of the Earth through the galaxy. So this is a beautiful new idea, you know, and think about it relating to, this is all during a period we know that life, not human life, but life on Earth has existed for probably 3 to 3.5 billion years, almost as long as the Earth has been around, you know, has been formed from this, since time was formed from the sun, from the cloud around the sun. So here we're getting determinations of very, you know, fascinating determinations. It just begins to to get at what kinds of things we might discover.
Well, this is all the more reason that Kepler takes on a new importance, and it also the reason we have an extraterrestrial imperative to get out there closer up and see what we're looking at.
Yeah, exactly. And the very existence of life is dependent on these things. The variations of life depends on the variations in the magnetic fields of the Earth itself and around the Earth. And the cosmic radiation is determining life because it's determining the atmosphere. So we've got a beautiful, you know, huge harmonic system here that we're just beginning to understand.
Well, Larry, in just a moment I'm going to open it up for a roundtable with bringing in Wes and Natalie again. But let me just throw out one more aspect of this. In his webcast, Lyndon LaRouche spoke of the importance of the British role, in particular Tony Blair.
Yeah.
And we've learned some new things in the last couple of days of Al Gore, British agent. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, we learned that last fall Gore was hired as a climate expert by the Blair government, by his Chancellor of the Exchequer, Nicholas Brown.
And Gordon Brown.
Gordon Brown. an inside source told us. Well, let me say another piece of this. It turns out we've also just learned from looking into this climate science that the leading center of the global warming hokery is in Britain, not surprisingly. The University of East Anglia, they brag about it, the University of East Anglia in northeast of London, claims to have the largest number of colleges devoted to environmental sciences. A recent expose by an opponent of the global warming stuff showed, you know, one of these academics who found that anyone who opposed was being silenced. Well, there's a very small group, a little mafia of, it totals 43 people, and there's a steering committee of them, which amounts to about 7 people, who referee, peer review, all of the papers. These days, if you want to get a paper published on this subject, you go through this peer review process that's controlled by a group of 7 people.
Except if you want it in 21st century science.
Right. Three of those 7 people are from East Anglia. East Anglia also had this, British University also had the largest representation at the IPCC. So 3 of them are from there. The 4th is Michael Mann, of the famous from our Penn State University, the famous Mann hockey stick curve, which used phony data to show that the Earth has never been warmer than now. Al Gore believes it, but you know that man can believe a lot of things. I think he thinks he's going to get rich on his latest hedge fund, you know, in generations investment. So
well,
there's a sucker born every minute.
Let me just take up the one question we got in so far on the email, and then we'll open it up for Wes and Natalie. We have a question from Santiago Hilaret, who basically writes about King Abdullah from Jordan coming to the Congress and bringing up Franklin Roosevelt, and he as a positive role for the United States, and he references the fact that this was also celebrated in Russia by Putin and others, the anniversary of Roosevelt's birth recently.
Mm-hmm.
And he asks, well, was King Abdullah risking getting shot by Cheney by doing this? And I think the broader question here, we don't have time to take it up, but there's a significant shift underway in the Middle East, which points a way out of the Cheney-Bush war doctrine. But unless we get impeachment in the United States, it's good King Abdullah's doing this. But we've got to have a mobilization in the United States, just as we have to straighten out this fraud in the sciences. So with that, let me just open it up to Wes or Natalie if you have any questions for Larry or something that you want to bring up.
Yeah, Larry?
Yes.
You had mentioned that the terrestrial magnetic field has been correlated to the increases in the cosmic rays that create these clouds. And I was wondering also about the relationship of that magnetic field and then what you're getting from the solar wind, which is also the magnetic radiation. Is there a relationship between that?
Well, again, it's the two working together. So it's this, you know, it's like when Kepler gets into the harmonies and all the different planets and how they're one. He looks at the relation of one to the next one, but then the whole thing is an integrated system, is a harmonic system. So you have the modulation of the incoming cosmic rays by the Earth's magnetic field, and then a stronger effect from the sun's, and then you have the effect from from outside of the solar system of the strength itself of the cosmic radiation varying. So you get an interrelated variation of thing, which is typical of how these things work. You know, you get these combined effects, and as Wes was saying, nothing is this simple. You know, nothing is so simple as a hedge fund prospectus where just, put your money here and it all keeps going up. If you believe in magic, things work that way.
And what's so special about these cosmic rays? What type of energy is this?
Well, these are very, very high-velocity protons. It's just very high-velocity particles. But, of course, they're not really particles. That gets into the interesting question that I just never thought we could... Well, you have time enough to unravel on a short time of a radio show, but you know it's what I addressed in the second part of the article in the current EIR, the one on climatology, where this then gets into relations. We used to collaborate with a fellow by the name of Dr. Eric Baga. He had been Werner Heisenberg's assistant on the German project, the German World War II project to try and build a bomb, which worried us quite a bit in the beginning of the war, and we were seriously worried. Later it turned out that it, they weren't going to get anywhere. Hitler was so stupid he didn't know to push it. And they didn't have the capabilities. But Baga became a collaborator of the Fusion Energy Foundation, the predecessor of our 21st century science. And we met him in Europe, and he came over here in 1985 and had a meeting with another famous veteran of the World War II period scientist, Dr. Robert Moon, who had been a key figure in the American side of the, you know, the Manhattan Project to try and build a bomb and later harness civilian nuclear power. So the two met and had an interesting exchange. One of the issues was Baga thought that was questioning the basis of neutrino theory. As I say, this gets into so many, it takes a long time to develop this all. But there is a connection between the gamma radiation coming from, he pointed to the Crab Nebula in particular, which is a source not only of the high-energy protons, but of gamma rays, which are just like a light waves of extremely high frequency, not visible light, but very high-frequency electromagnetic radiation. That's related with these things going on. He was challenging the standard accepted theory, which is another one of these phony baloney. You know, everybody in physics, people think that physics is some sort of pure truth and all of that. In fact, it's probably more political than what goes on every day in the corridors of the U.S. Congress. And all the way back in 1930, there was a theory based on absolutely nothing proposed by a guy named Wolfgang Pauli at a conference that Baga attended. Pauli couldn't come, but he wrote a letter to it that you can find on the Internet, and said that that an invisible particle called the neutrino explain certain paradoxes that go on when in nuclear decay, when in nuclear radiation. So that theory, Baga thought it was hogwash and was working all his life on alternative explanations to get at what the real truth of that was, this question of what's called pair production, electron-positron. That's where antimatter comes in, you know, the particle and its antiparticle called the electron and the positron, which has the same mass but lives for a very short time, but has the opposite charge. It goes the opposite way in a magnetic field. So that's the sort of thing you get into there.
Well, Larry, if the listeners want to pursue this, I presume we're going to be conducting a whole series of articles in the 21st Century Science and Technology magazine. How can the listeners get a hold of that?
I think we will. Yeah, well, go to the website. They can call that same number you gave, the 800 number, and get a subscription. Or just go to but we've got a lot up on the website, which is www.21stcenturyscientetech.com. So it's 21st is 21st, Century Science Tech, T-E-C-H, 21stcenturyscientetech.com, or just Google 21st Century Science Science and Technology Magazine, and you'll find it. You'll also find a lot on the Ice Ages and earlier articles by Dr. Jaworski and others, also by myself, that will go into depth on this whole question of the Ice Ages, and I think if people read that, they'll be well convinced that this is a fraud and have the ammunition to knock this Gore fraud for a loop, which it really needs to happen and happen fast.
And for our younger listeners, they'll be able to be prepared to then come into the classes on Kepler and work through these great works that people have been working on in the basement.
At Wayne. And actually for that, they should also go to the WLYM site, WLYM.com. www.wlym.com. They've got a beautiful section there, their animation section, where this latest work on Kepler and the harmonies is. It's beautiful, very good pedagogy. It's clear, it's very clear, not easy to understand, but very comprehensible if you do the work, which turns out to be fun. It draws you in, and it's just great. I found it myself tremendously inspiring and gotten all kinds of new ideas which resonate with these earlier thoughts that I had in this work on climatology, which you see, it's all of our whole understanding of nature is tied in with this.
Well, we have about.
Can I ask you a question on that?
Yeah, I was just going to say we have about 7 minutes left, so go ahead, Wes.
Okay, well, on this question of the harmonies, Kepler gets into this idea of looking at the periodicity of the orbits of the planets in relationship to the musical. And the ratio in terms of the division of a monochord and producing certain sounds and so forth. And it seems to me like, I mean, that's the idea that he puts forth in the principled harmonic nature of the universe would be applicable not only to we're looking at terms of understanding the question of ontology, but also some of the other stuff that you've been working on with this idea of the so-called isotope.
Yeah.
There, I know that we've had discussions, and you've been working on this idea of a certain ordering of the isotopes from the standpoint of frequencies, which Lynn recently said it wasn't just a question of, like, matter vibrating in different ways, but that something about these like, minuscule harmonic resonances. It is definitely a question that's on the forefront edge of physical chemistry. It's certainly not clear in my mind. So I was wondering if you could, like, develop this idea of looking at the physical chemistry from the standpoint of Riemann hypergeometries and how you begin to do that.
I'd love to talk about that in the 4 minutes remaining. It takes longer to spell it all out, but I have been working lately at in the same location where the up above the basement. So I've had quite a lot of interaction with the limb, this original work of the limb, and unraveling and reviving Kepler and now Gauss's work. So one of the great things that came out of that Kepler Harmonies work that they did, which people can find on WLIM.com, was that I realized something that I had been missing for a long time, or had let slide. Dr. Moon, who I mentioned before, in 1986-87, came up with he read Kepler's Mysterium Cosmographicum, the first major work. And he was so inspired by that and the combination of that and his work in the science seminars we were having then with LaRouche and a number of leading scientists, that he came up with a whole new conception of the atomic nucleus, something he had worked on all his life, and correlated to geometries, to the geometries of the Platonic solids, the nested Platonic solids, pretty much in the same way that Kepler had represented the orbits, the orbital distances, radial distances, of the then-known planets of the solar system. And when I learned about that, I just loved that. I had a love of geometry for a long time, and so I just went to town on that. But always I realized that the other side of it had to be there. That is the other side of Kepler's work. Kepler did that early work. Then he got into the question of the harmonies and spent all of his life trying to correlate the relationships determined by the geometries and by the Platonic solids and the Archimedean solids, and it gets into the truncated Archimedean solids, all these variations you can get, the relationship between that and the musical harmonies. And that's what was sparked in a question, that dichotomy was sparked in my mind again. I had left the harmonies a bit alone and had a breakthrough in my own thinking as a result of the youth work, and started looking at just some simple things about the relationships of the masses of the elements in the periodic table and what that related to. Can't give it in 2 minutes, but what that related to is the fact that you're getting at here, that it had been what's called the wave-particle paradox. This had been developed back in the 1920s by the work of Louis de Broglie. He saw that the work done by light, by a moving light wave, is quite the same as the work done by a moving so-called particle. But that in the case of a light wave, you're talking about something that is, somewhat an invisible process. And something that has a frequency, and that with respect to other light waves and other forms of energy can have harmonic relationships. And that so that you're getting more closer there to what's really the foundation of science, which is the fact that what we seem to see in our senses, objects and things and particles, are not the reality. But the reality is an underlying cause that's behind that, is a continuously changing process of creation that's behind that, which is often better represented to us, that rather than looking at particle relationships, is better represented to us by the sorts of things you find in musical harmonies. And that's what Kepler was getting at, and there's a relationship between that and geometry, where geometry also is not objects, though you can build models and so forth, but it's actually those sorts of changes which are expressed in your own mind's ability to grasp things.
Well, and Larry, this is where Lynn spoke of the importance of singing and music as putting the passion back into the scientific work, and then bringing from science the rigor, the precise rigor, into the music.
Yes.
And that in fact, is what we're talking about, is a total transformation of education in this country.
That's right. I unfortunately didn't have a very good music education. I wish I had. I can appreciate it more than I can create it. But that's it. That's it exactly, Harley. And it's the passion of music and of poetry is what drives any scientist forward. You know, it can't, it's not just...
Well, as opposed to the dull monotone which Wes identified in Al Gore's droning Academy Award performance.
Exactly.
So, again, we're running out of time. Larry, thank you very much for joining us. There's a whole lot more we could talk about on this. Wes and Natalie, let's keep the organizing going and the crossfire. I would urge people to get your friends to listen to this. Go to the LaRouchePub.com archive. You can pick it up under the LaRouche Show. Make a DVD of it. Burn a DVD. Get it around. Get people talking. And get people regularly looking at the 21st Century Science and Technology website. And join us with the LaRouche Movement, because we've got a limited amount of time to defeat this hoax, or this hoax will destroy the United States and the world economy. So again, thank you, and join us next week when the LaRouche Show will be on, as always, Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time.